This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Elections Canada has reached out to various social media platforms to address concerns around misinformation. So Chief Electoral Officer Stéphane Pedeau said that he's been in contact with sites like X and TikTok. He said he's been satisfied with the response so far. But what does that mean? What does protecting Canadians online look like? And how can Manitobans be aware of misinformation?
The 2025 federal election is now a couple of weeks old, and the battle for attention and ultimately votes is taking place both offline and online. The enormous influence of sites such as Facebook, TikTok, and X or Twitter, along with a handful of others, raises real issues about how information spreads, its reliability, and risks of misinformation and disinformation. Angus Bridgman is the director of the Media Ecosystem Observatory and an assistant professor of research at the Max Bell School of Public Policy at McGill University, a contributor to studies on information issues in multiple federal and provincial elections. He is one of Canada's leading experts on misinformation, digital activism, and the politics of digital media. He joins me on the podcast to talk about the state of the major platforms in Canada in 2025, how our information ecosystem is vulnerable to misinformation, and what we should be doing about it. Angus, welcome to the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining. You know, with election 2025 underway, there's a battle for attention and of course, ultimately for votes. And that battle certainly is taking place both online and offline. You led a major study on misinformation and disinformation during the last federal campaign back in the 2021 election. And I know that you're actively monitoring the social media activity right now with this new election call. I want to start first with the last campaign. Can you talk a little bit about that study and report and what you found, particularly with respect to misinformation?
So in 2021, what we really found was that there was rampant misinformation. We kind of know this. Anyone who spends time online, you're just a click and a hop away from accessing misinformation on whatever social media platform you are. And this isn't a partisan issue. This isn't a political ideology issue. It's simply go look at kind of what heavy partisans are saying on any side, and it's sort of rife with misinformation. So like we found that there absolutely was misinformation during the campaign. We documented a few instances of sort of seeming more coordinated, like information influence type things. But generally our assessment in 2021 is that there was sort of no major incidents that sort of had a material impact on the outcome of the election. And this is sort of a view that has kind of been interesting, and particularly in the light of course, Erin O'Toole and the Conservative Party's commentary on this during that election and the immediate aftermath, where particularly sort of that Chinese diaspora influence was really highlighted as an instance of, hey, this seems, I think, kind of during the campaign, there was some claims. And then right after it was like that it materially impacted the outcome of almost a dozen ridings was sort of the claim. Look, our evidence, our data didn't show that, but it's hard to know at the riding level. So our general conclusion was, look, the election was reasonably free and fair, with the caveat that, look, online spaces are becoming great spaces for sharing information and for having dialogue. But part of that and part of the joy of free speech on platforms is that you get a lot of false, misleading content. And I would say that has only increased since then.
Okay. I did want to ask you specifically about what's changed. And I want to get into each of the different platforms if we could in just a sec. But, you know, it's been 4 years. Is your sense, and I think it's probably self-evident to a lot of people who spend a lot of time online, that these kinds of issues have accelerated? And are there other kinds of things people at a higher level ought to be thinking about as we enter into a new campaign?
Yeah. I remember, you know, you always find things to be worried about, right? Like in the election, we were really worried about something. I recall in 2021, the Facebook had this election integrity initiative, a Canadian election integrity initiative. They don't have one this time around, but they had one back in 2021. And one of the things they talked about was changing, tweaking the algorithm around civic content, what they call civic content. So how much political, and this was, you know, I recall doing, you know, CBC syndication across the country and talking about the flaws of this and how they're doing it in a non-transparent way. It kind of seems quaint In today's day and age, where like Facebook no longer has CrowdTangle or data access for researchers, it doesn't have an election integrity or a well-resourced trust and safety team any longer, and you can't get Canadian news platform content because of the Online News Act and sort of the subsequent reaction to it. So it's quaint, to think back on those concerns, but you always find things to be concerned about. And for sure, there's some big changes. I would say, first off, like the platform change is real. Like the way platforms think about their role and their community and their spaces is just very different. And that's partly just going where the winds are blowing in Washington, right? So of course, it started with Musk and X, the riot, like community notes, the reduction of their trust and safety teams, the removal of content moderation, the unbanning and unblocking of people on that platform, and sort of the fairly marked, and I think at this point, uncontroversial shift to the right of that platform, which, for better or worse, that's what that space is now. So they have taken a pretty hard line on data transparency and the value of moderation versus freedom of speech. And that has sort of cascaded out into the other platforms. And so we're seeing that on the major Meta platforms and to a lesser extent on Google as well. So there's the platform change. And then the other thing that I just think Canadians are kind of aware of, but maybe just to really underline is in 2021, we were kind of concerned about China and sort of Russia. In 2025, those actors are still absolutely there, but there's been repeated instances of India now, meddling in the information space in Canada. There's been several high-profile kind of instances and reports and public conversations about that. And then, of course, now going into the election, there's just a real concern about American influence. And there's a useful distinction here between influence, which is just that's what politics is, trying to influence other people, and interference. So some degree of coordination, information manipulation, et cetera. And so, Joe Rogan says something about Canada that's misinformed about this state of the Online News Act or the Online Harms Act, right? So he came out after the Online Harms Act was already dead and came out and talked about how this was going to be the reality. This is the issue. I think he said this is the law in Canada, right? And of course that bill doesn't exist anymore, and it definitely isn't the law. So, he can say what he wants, and he just goes out and says that. And Canadians can account for that and integrate that into their understanding of the world. But if it starts to become coordinated and lots of influencers talking about it suspiciously at the same time, and there's this sort of like clear agenda that's being pushed, that's really the space that makes me more concerned. And so I think that interference possibility from the states is real this time around and something that we really got to watch. So there's like a different kind of threat landscape. Sorry, there's a long answer. The last one I'll say is just like bots and AI are just a totally different ball game than 2021. So we did this investigation into the Kirkland Lake bot incident last year. Part of that was going to sort of crypto marketplaces where we can find and purchase X accounts. About 20 cents for an aged X account. Now, 20 cents is trivial. Think about somebody trying to influence an election. You can buy 10,000 bots for $2,000. It's like a trivial expense from somebody. That's chump change for somebody involved in politics. 10,000 bots. Think about how many engagements and comments our X posts get. Like 10,000 is material. Even if some small set of that bots was activated in response to a post and amplified it in the early times, can have a huge impact, and it can be hard to detect and hard to understand. And so there's that, and then there's generative AI, which is just causing all sorts of problems in the information space.
Yeah, no, you've touched on a lot of things that I want to drill down a little bit more on.
Yeah.
Why don't we circle back to Meta, of course, for certainly for people who listen to my podcast, a lot of the focus has been on the Online News Act. What are you seeing so far with respect to the people using either Facebook or Instagram, use of groups, other kinds of things where there may be blocked news links, but as you mentioned, some of the other kinds of efforts that Facebook undertook in the past may have disappeared. The priorities or the policy focus of the company clearly seems to have changed post Trump inauguration, and other kinds of things people should be on the lookout for with respect to those platforms.
Lots of Canadians say they get their political news from Facebook. Lots of people. You ask Canadians, do they know that news is blocked on Facebook and Instagram? About 25% know that it's blocked. Of the people who regularly use that platform, that number goes up to about 35%. Of the people who regularly use the platform and say they get it for news, only about half know that news is blocked on that platform. So this is just fascinating, right? Like if you think of news as something that news organizations provide and they are the exclusive provider of, it makes no sense that half of Canadians who use those platforms for political information think that they or don't know that the news is blocked. How are they? What are they reading, right? So what they're reading is other people sharing information. There are some workarounds. You know, you can copy paste link or copy paste content. You can link out to X, and then that, you know, it's a two-click solution as opposed to a one-click solution out to a news. There's screenshots. We've seen a lot of just screenshot the news story, just screenshot and just post it. So there's a few workarounds of this. But in general, people are still saying they're getting the news from the platform, right? And they still think that they're getting informed. And that's just, it's a very interesting kind of puzzle for news organizations, and I think really an existential challenge, right? Like this is okay, if people say they're getting the news, but they don't even know we're blocked. What is our role? What is actually our role and our reason for being there? So I don't know. I think I kind of trailed off the direct line there, but it's kind of just a very interesting kind of anecdote or some survey data on what's going on that platform.
Yeah, I listened to your interview on The House, and you talked a bit about Facebook groups and how they're being repurposed and acquired. Could you talk a bit about that technique in terms of efforts to try to influence what people are thinking about or reading when it comes to that platform?
There's a whole set of tactics that can be used. And this is kind of like one that you wouldn't think of, but kind of makes sense. So you can go on crypto marketplaces and purchase old Facebook groups and repurpose them. So you become the admin, you can change it to whatever you want, and it still has many members. We looked into this. It's not that expensive to do. So you can get groups with 50, 60, 70,000 members for a few hundred Canadian, right? So it's, you know, this is like even affordable for a hobbyist to do something like this. Then you get some bots and you kind of move it around. There's one group in the Canadian context that has about 20,000 members, and it's sort of Canadians for 51st Statehood. I forget the exact name of the group, and private group on Facebook, created 10 years ago and seems to be administered by an American. I mean, that's like some interesting stylized facts about that experience, right? And looking kind of at the posts of that group, it's not a huge amount of engagement. So it's kind of really had those signs of a dead group that's been repurposed, and even some people posting in it saying like, why was I added to this group? You know, so again, maybe they were part of some community group in the past that went dormant and now it's been reactivated or sold. And so that can certainly happen on Facebook. And this general challenge of like selling and rebranding accounts and groups and channels is widespread. There are marketplaces where you can purchase any of these aged accounts. The really interesting thing for any gamers listening is that these marketplaces largely started as gaming account kind of sharing things. So you had a World of Warcraft account with some gold, you wanted to sell it. Hey, what other accounts could we start sell? Could we sell YouTube accounts? Could we sell Facebook accounts? Hey, we could sell Facebook groups too. And so now it's sort of, there's a whole ecosystem where you can purchase this stuff. And just because you see a group with 20,000 members, it doesn't mean that 20,000 people believe that.
Okay. It's interesting to hear about that marketplace. You mentioned the other marketplace a few moments ago in terms of trying to acquire Twitter or X accounts as part of a strategy. Now that's of course another platform that between the last election and this election undergone a pretty major change. Company's been renamed and obviously new ownership under Elon Musk. What are you seeing on that platform? I could say from my own experience with a fairly large follower base, it's pretty clear a lot of people have abandoned, at least in my world, a lot of people have abandoned that platform. And the you can oftentimes, just from my own experience, sort of see the engagement go up or down depending on how the algorithm happens to interact with a particular tweet or post that I make. Sometimes it flies, and other times there's stuff that I think is interesting but doesn't really go anywhere. And it's pretty clear that the algorithm's having a pretty big impact. What are some of the kind of things that you're seeing on that platform?
There's certainly something about this where there's a bit of chance and randomness on that platform now, where the content that you think is the best and needs to be seen by the most people is completely disregarded. And then you look and there's some random very unfunny post and it's got 6 million views, and you go, what's going on there? Like, why is that the way it works? But lots of people are still using it, and we do some polling on this, and what we found is in the last year, amongst Liberal and NDP partisans in Canada, usage is down by about 15%. 15% is not nothing, but it's not droves of people either. It's not everyone kind of abandoning wholesale the platform. There's been a few like fits and start movement. Oh, let's all go to Mastodon. Oh, let's all go to Blue Sky. And that's happened a few times, but it hasn't seemed to dent it. I mean, 15% is not nothing, but it's not that much either. Meanwhile, kind of conservative partisans are using it at about the same rate. So there hasn't been kind of an influx on that platform either. Look, we know on that platform there's been a dramatic shift to the right, that right-wing accounts are getting much more engagement and likes, and partly that's probably the who's on the platform now and who's spending time and how the algorithm works, and partly it's probably just the Musk effect. He amplifies something, and then everything that kind of sounds like that is going to get a boost too, and roll out. That one of the striking things to me about X is, like, X used to be the platform that was the most studied by academics. Like, in many ways, like, all of our tooling and our understanding of the online ecosystem is driven by Twitter studies. I mean, there's been a lot of papers written about how it's Twitter, like, it's just this whole thing. But because the data was so accessible, and now it's not. Now it is prohibitively expensive. The access that we used to get at the observatory that I run, where we had multiple academics with an academic API, we were basically able to get every tweet ever posted in Canada. To get that type of access now would be upwards of $150,000 a month to get that, which is, like, obviously just like, what are we talking about here? Like, this is ridiculous. So the data access has changed, and with that, visibility into that platform is way down. And so we want to know kind of what's going on. You can kind of see, you can get impressions, but you've got to be careful with that, because these are often hyper individualized experiences. And what people see is determined in part by their follow preferences, but mostly by their behavior. And that behavior varies widely from person to person. And so it's hard to know exactly what's going on the platform. What I can tell you for sure is that right-wing content, Canadian politician content, right-wing news in Canada is all doing well, and left-wing content in general is doing quite poorly. Although there was actually a bit of a bump around the, sort of the end of the Liberal leadership race, and a lot of the Liberal members of parliament and a lot of that content was actually doing reasonably well on the platform, which is maybe an argument for it's not, it's about amplification and energy as opposed to about right-wing or left-wing.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. It's somewhat surprising. We've been talking about platforms, and the name TikTok hasn't come up at all yet. It's been such a focal point politically in terms of Chinese influence, and of course, what takes place on that platform is it's grown in popularity so much, and particularly the last few years. Is that a focal point at all for some of the research that you do, and the prospect of having influence on the upcoming campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. There's the interference angle. There's sort of the new type of platform that it is and the way it works. There's the Americanization of the in continued Americanization of the Canadian information environment, which is very strong on TikTok because of the way things get amplified. TikTok, like, still of the major five that we follow, so YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, X, and TikTok. TikTok is still actually the least used, but people who are on TikTok are very passionate about their TikTok use, and they spend a lot of time on TikTok as well. So, it matters. There's other reasons to think it matters. So, one of the things that we saw about Canadian news on Meta and X is just, like, engagement and visibility tanked. Like, obviously because of the ban, but also on X because they have this link tank. So if you, like, your article gets posted and it's got a link, you just it's it needs to go viral in order to get anything, but it's got a steep hill to climb to get there. And so even outlets like Rebel, which you might think, okay, now have an increased audience on that platform, actually their posts with links tend not to do super well because of that tax. So Rebel's not doing well, and for sure, like, the big media outlets on X are not doing well. All that to say, they actually get most of their engagement now on TikTok. So the social traffic that's being driven to the major news outlets in this country is largely coming from TikTok, which is just, like, a total change from a year and a half ago, where it was negligible and non-existent. So there's the news content angle. There's also the politician angle, which is really interesting about the platform. Because of some of these security concerns and some of the bans on government devices and things, TikTok uptake has been pretty low in Canada amongst the political class. And you saw like Singh cancel his TikTok that was his primary way really of communicating his message. And he's brought it back, and he's had a couple viral moments on that platform and has been doing reasonably well. And it's, I think it's actually just a fascinating, that in particular is a fascinating case study in like how politicians don't have so much of a choice of what platforms they engage on. You kind of got to do it. And we saw that like with the Liberals passed the Online News Act, Facebook turns off news on their platform. This is like a moment in democracy where if you believe that Meta has made the wrong choice, you might change your behavior in some way. You might say, hey, I'm going to post less. I'm going to use that platform less. I'm going to spend less of my advertising money on that platform. Except I need to reach my constituents, I need to reach Canadians, and I want to do it. And if you look at the ad registry now on Facebook,
Exactly.
that's where the money's being spent in the campaign. Oh, you know, there's something funny about that, but also, I don't know if sad is the word, but just like instructive, that you actually kind of need to be on these platforms. You need to meet Canadians where they are, and social is where people increasingly are. And so you don't have a huge choice, even on X. Like X is where Chrystia Freeland announced her resignation. X is where Trudeau sent his final farewell to Canadians. You know, they don't agree with Musk. They don't agree with the Musk's proximity to the, you know, US administration or some of the policies being pushed there. They want to use the platform to amplify their message. And so that just, they're kind of tied to it. And so we haven't seen that to the same extent on TikTok. We haven't seen that migration, but I expect that to change pretty rapidly, because that is where a lot of the energy, I would say like the bulk of the energy in politics is on X and TikTok now.
Okay. That's interesting. You mentioned you follow five platforms. Why don't we just complete it then with the Google YouTube? What role do they play? They sometimes get missed as part of the discussion, as compared to some of the other larger social media players, but how important is particularly the video side on YouTube?
So YouTube is an interesting beast because YouTube is the most used platform by far out of it. Everyone knows YouTube. You know, you need to repair something, you need to sew, like, you know, people use Facebook for all sorts of reasons. Some Canadians get their news on Facebook, but it's like the lowest percentage by platform is the YouTube. Trudeau, at its peak, his YouTube channel had about 5,000 followers. To give you a sense, his X handle had 6.6 million and his YouTube had 5,000. So this is indicative of a different approach. The only politicians who do well on YouTube are right-wing politicians. Poilievre has a large channel, and a few others as well have a decent sized following on that platform. So that's kind of an interesting kind of politician thing. Media outlets use it to scare their content and pump it out there. It does okay. You know, it's used a little bit. I think generally the influencer group has found that that platform is not the best place, that podcasts, TikTok, even some of the more dynamic social platforms are better. It's partly because we don't have the same market here in Canada as we have in the States. Like a lot of American content creators use YouTube and they make a lot of money from it, but you can't really make that living in Canada producing Canadian politics content. Like some people make it work. I don't know. There's like a handful, you know, like the Paul Wells and the Justin Ling of the world, Rachel Gilmore, like they seem to be able to kind of cobble it together. But there's some cobbling going on.
Yeah, it's interesting to compare and contrast what takes place here compared to elsewhere. You know, you mentioned that the generative AI more broadly, of course, has been one of the really big changes over the last few years. Can you describe in a little bit more detail what role that generative AI, whether ChatGPT or otherwise, plays in terms of either creating some of this content, influencing the sorts of things that we see? What role has some of this AI generated content begun to play from a social media political conversation perspective?
There's a lot of layers to this question. Maybe I'll talk about two layers, the two layers I find most interesting. First of all, there's tons of AI generated content on social media. The images are normally pretty easy to spot, sort of the AI slop, the AI video kind of stuff, the images. It's not too sophisticated. It's not, it's noteworthy. It allows you to produce content that is visually like appealing or interesting pretty quickly. I don't think that's been too material yet. We'll see kind of as the sophistication of those models improves. The text side of things is rampant. There is just an astonishing volume of bot LLM detected content across every social media platform. Through the DSA in Europe, a lot of platforms have to, or the platforms have to provide sort of some mandatory reporting. And one of the things they talk about is sort of like bot takedowns and things. And bots, in order to be effective, need to be powered by a language model because otherwise they can't do their job. And what we're seeing is just a huge amount of content coming through. So that's like, it's happening. Everyone knows it's happening. It's at scale. Okay. Which leads to this interesting kind of layer two problem, which is if you don't know if something was created by a human or not, how do you trust anything that's said online? And there was this mistrust in the past, but it's getting worse. It's very hard to know when you go on Facebook or Instagram and you read the comment section, and lots of people read the comment section and like to go there to get reactions. It's like another lazy brain shortcut. You're like, I don't know how to react to this. Let's just read the comments and that'll inform my perspective. It's really tough to know. I would say almost impossible. At times, if the generative AI content is poorly done, fine. But GPT 4.5, which is still trivial to produce, like the cost is trivial to produce messages, you can make it sound pretty human with a couple of wise prompting decisions and a good pipeline. So that level two issue, I think, is really interesting because it might lead in the very near future to increased distrust of everything online to the point where people start to disconnect from that being any viable signal of population level attitudes. Because this actually, there's been a number of studies that have looked at this, and like politicians, journalists, and the public actually respond to like counts and retweets and the comments on social. Like it's hard not to. Our brains are kind of wired to like take those cues. And so, all of those cues are getting softened in a certain way because you don't know. You can't verify. And so, I mean, maybe that's a net positive in the end, because in the past, people kind of knew that, but they thought it was maybe difficult to do. It wasn't that difficult to do, but they thought it was maybe more difficult. Now it's so easy to do that there might actually be that increased skepticism and disconnection and increased kind of reliance on profile level signals. Like, does this person look like a bot? Are they consistently? Are they producing content? And more reliance on like verified accounts, not verified in the sense of a blue check mark on X, but verified in the sense of you know this person and you've seen them around on that social in that social space.
So what should the government be doing, or what has the government been doing to try to counter or to address some of these issues?
So the Hogue Commission came out with 51 recommendations, 22 of which were supposed to be put in place before the next election. I don't think all of them have been put in place. Some of them have. This is a really tricky legal and policy. It's a thorny issue that governments all around the world are struggling with. I think kind of some of the same themes are rising to the top around the world, and sort of alluded to it, but like the need for greater transparency is so critical in this space. So policing speech doesn't really work. Heavy content moderation just drives people into other platforms where they actually form more insular communities and the rhetoric potentially gets more extreme. That's not really what is a successful strategy. The most successful strategy is additional transparency and clarity. People want to be informed, so you need to help them be informed and help avoid the manipulation that can happen at scale. So what can government do there? I mean, there's actually a lot. I think, and ask a researcher what they want. They want more data. But genuinely, I think that the lack of visibility and transparency that platforms have into particularly like manipulation campaigns, is astonishingly like is unacceptable in my view. This is an industry that has very successfully avoided having to provide rich data to researchers. And you know what? The irritating thing is that researchers are going to bop you over the head over and over and over again because they're going to find problems. But that's part of the process. And there does need to be greater transparency in that space. And that's kind of what DSA in the EU is has kind of moved a little bit towards. So for sure the data transparency, I'd love to see government be much more transparent. We had a Globe story about Indian interference in the conservative leadership race in 2022. 2025, like, what's going on here? Like, why th this is something, there is no process by which that sort of intelligence and that sort of information can be made public, and there can be a conversation about that in kind of a responsible way, or responsible in the sense that there's some transparency about what sort of information campaigns are occurring. This lack of transparency is really troubling. The Hogue Commission, the Foreign Interference Commission, there were all sorts of documents, really interesting documents. I'm an expert in the space that I learned about how government operates and what they're finding. Intelligence, you know, all source intelligence is by its very nature secretive. But in the disinformation space in particular, you can't be super secretive because being super secretive means that false information, misleading, is allowed to flourish and thrive. It loves a vacuum. And we're not going to take the government's word for everything, but having that additional level of transparency when it doesn't threaten operational security seems like a no-brainer. And yet there's been a resistance. And the Hogue Commission talked about this a little bit, but I just, Canadians need to know what goes on in the information space, and they should be made aware of it. And that just seems fairly unobjectionable to me that that should be kind of a starting point. Okay, the Online Harms Act, the Online News Act, these are all policies trying to figure out better ways to govern these spaces. And I don't think those efforts should be abandoned, and they need attention too. But ground zero for me is additional transparency from intelligence, security, and platforms to allow people to, when they're operating in the information space, to at least kind of be informed about the dynamics. And that includes politicians. I mean, politicians, I've testified before a few parliamentary committees, and you know, they're very concerned about misinformation because they get targeted. And even they can't get answers when they write to the platforms. Even they can't get information. And if they can't, how can everyday Canadians do it?
Okay, so it's interesting to hear about some of the kinds of things that have been recommended through the Hogue Commission and otherwise in terms of what we could be doing. Why don't we wrap with this? What do you think that ordinary Canadians can be doing in the absence of some of the sort of steps towards transparency and otherwise? And what are you doing? You've been obviously actively involved in the observatory, tracking what's taking place. Can you talk a bit about what you anticipate happening or what is happening right now? When it comes to this particular election campaign and the work you and some of the other people in your research group have been doing.
So I'm part of this Coalition for Information Ecosystem Resilience, these names, big group of civil society research groups across the country that are trying to provide information to Canadians during the election about basically information manipulation. This is like largely what we're concerned in. Misinformation, false information. I like, not that we can't be bothered, and in certain instances it matters, like, you know, logistics of voting. You don't want logistics of voting for there to be false information out there. But in general, if politician X called politician Y a liar and there's this dispute, let them sort it out. Let the public have a conversation about that, whatever. It's the hidden stuff that I think is really kind of our sweet spot, and trying to understand kind of how bots, generative AI, foreign interference, influencer campaigns, astroturfing, et cetera, some of these phenomena manage to shape what we talk about and what we care about. And we're trying to sort of provide some transparency and visibility into that process for Canadians. So that's kind of what we're doing. We have a tip line, electiontipline.ca, where Canadians can go and put some screenshots of things. And we've had actually a great response so far. And I'm really loving the contributions of Canadians to this discussion. And we basically have a researcher go through and validate each one and take a look. And if it meets kind of our threshold of, look, this could be information manipulation, then you know, we really look into it. There's also, like, we shouldn't forget there's the Critical Election Incident Public Protocol, which is another mouthful of a name. That's the panel of the most senior public servants, and their job is to sound the alarm if they think there's been manipulation or interference at scale in Canada. And they've come out this election and said they're going to be a little bit louder than they were in 2019 and 2021, where actually we didn't hear from them at all because the threshold wasn't met. And so this was one of the recommendations of the Rosenberg Report, and one of the recommendations of the Hogue Commission was some greater transparency. And that panel is informed by intelligence and security services. They get briefings from cross-government, from the best knowledge that the Canadian government can mobilize. And so that's going to be another mechanism. It's going to be really interesting to see how they talk during the election and how they intervene and what they say. So there's, a few mechanisms, but ultimately it's the information space. It's chaotic and high energy. And so, Canadians need to sort of make smart, intentional choices. And I don't think, government can help in some way, but this is an information literacy. This is a, responsibility type question. I don't know about this analogy. I've been saying it, I'll share it. There's this Buy Canadian movement. You go to the grocery store, you check the label, you care about that. Do the same thing in Canada. And I don't mean consume CBC or Radio Canada. That's not what I'm saying. What I mean is check to see if the person you're paying attention to and you care about their opinion, are they Canadian? Do they care about Canadians? Do they care about your community? Look, if the answer to any of those is yes, great. I don't care what they say. If the answer to any of them is maybe or no, maybe during an election, a national conversation about our future, maybe that those opinions should be discounted a little bit. And those are decisions that Canadians need to make. And there is, I think generally people do care that the information they're receiving is true. They want to be informed about the world. And so the role of groups like ours should not be to say what is true and what is false, not to police the information ecosystem. It's to try to give as much information as we can. And we're not perfect. We have a limited set of tools. We can only do so much, but we can provide some information, some context. Hey, there was a bot network active on this topic that you would have seen. And we can provide that information in a way that that other research groups really can't. So that's really exciting, and we're going to have fun.
Angus, you've been at the forefront of some of these issues, and it's pretty clear that the next few weeks are going to be high energy and a lot going on. So I'm grateful for the work that you've been doing and for taking the time to join me on the podcast during unquestionably a busy time to talk about both these issues and what people ought to be thinking about as the campaign unfolds.
Thanks so much for hosting.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod, or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca, or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.